The explosive new film, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, exposes secrets behind the government's takedown of General Michael Flynn.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
He told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire. They had to get rid of Flynn.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.
Good evening, and welcome to The Business of Giving. I'm Denver Frederick, and thank you for joining me tonight. You'll be hearing from two exceptionally significant figures in the world of philanthropy. We'll begin with Rebecca Rimel, the president and CEO of the Pew Charitable Trust, as innovative and influential as any public charity. And they are very disciplined and very intentional about what issues they will take on.
And we basically say that we won't enter a new topic or issue unless we feel that we have a 60-40 chance of winning on behalf of the public.
Mm-hmm.
Because the opportunity cost is very high when we take on new lines of work. So it can range from antibiotic resistance to corrections reform to trying to set aside 1 billion acres in the boreal to a new generation of parks in the sea.
And then I will speak with Jeff Walker, the chairman of New Profit and the author of the Generosity Network. And he believes we would make great headway solving social problems if we acted more like a jazz ensemble.
And so thinking about, you know, the successful ensembles, they almost always talk about it as a religious event when it works well. Something spiritual just happened. How are we working that well together?
Mm-hmm.
It's like feels great. You know, how do we do that? And I continually look for that feeling. And trying to unite people together to have that exciting, you know, opportunity to make the world a better place, but do it together.
But first, the Business Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. Almost half of all people surveyed said if it were easier and more convenient to donate to their favorite cause online, they would definitely or probably give more. Furthermore, the majority of donors in their 30s or younger said the ease of giving to the cause online is the decisive factor in whether they'll trust a nonprofit organization. Giving in support of disaster relief efforts is top of mind for donors as Giving Tuesday and the end of the year season approaches, according to a survey conducted by Classy. One Feeds Two USA donates a meal to a hungry child in the developing world for every purchase, and it's starting to get more and more restaurants on board. Rice University announced free tuition for low- and middle-income students. Microsoft will start requiring partners and suppliers to offer paid family leave, and it will help cover those costs. According to the CDC, babies born with syphilis just reached a 20-year high. And finally, a new IKEA report gives an unsettling look at life in the 21st century. Among the findings, almost half of Americans, 45%, go to their car to have a private moment to themselves, and 53% of young families don't get a sense of belonging from their residential home. And that is a Business of Giving News Digest for this Sunday evening. I'll be back to speak with Rebecca Rimel of the Pew Charitable Trust right after this.
Technology can change lives, but underserved communities around the world have yet to experience all the benefits technology offers. Benetech is a nonprofit whose mission is to empower communities in need by creating scalable technology solutions. Their work has transformed how 500,000 people with disabilities access information, made it easier and safer for human rights defenders to document violations, and equipped environmental conservationists to protect ecosystems. Learn more by visiting benetech.org. Follow the Business of Giving on Twitter at BizOfGive and at Facebook.com/BusinessOfGiving. And now, back to the Business of Giving with your host, Denver Frederick, on AM 970, The Answer.
Most listeners are familiar with the Pew Research Poll, but what they may not be aware of is that that's just the tip of the iceberg to one of the most extraordinary, multifaceted, and innovative charities in the country doing some really interesting stuff. And the architect of all this, building upon the legacy of the founders, is with us now. She is Rebecca Rimel, president and CEO of the Pew Charitable Trust. Good evening, Rebecca, and welcome to the Business of Giving.
Well, thank you so much for having me. I'm honored.
Pew is 70 years old this year, and my goodness, you've been here for just about half that amount of time. Share with us some of the history and the evolution of the organization, starting with, if you would, the Pews themselves.
Well, the two sons and two daughters of Joseph Newton Pugh, the founder of Sun Oil, started the Pugh Charitable Trust. They were deeply religious people, and they believe very much in the biblical teaching that to those who much is given, much is expected. So they dividended back all of their wealth to create seven individual trusts to honor their parents and each one of them individually. And today, we try to steward that legacy and honor that gift.
Mm-hmm. And Pugh became a public charity about 15 years ago. Rebecca, what's the difference between a private foundation and a public charity, and what were the advantages of doing this?
Well, only trust and estates lawyers would enjoy my four-hour answer here. But simply put, a private foundation, and your listeners will know many, the Gates Foundation, Rockefeller, Ford, and others, are usually the beneficiaries of one donor or one family. They accomplish their work generally by making grants, that is, outsourcing to other organizations to support very important efforts. Public charities are all of the nonprofits that no doubt your listeners contribute to.
Mm-hmm.
The Girl Scouts, their college or university. And it's called a public charity because it gets public support. And we were able to make that transition through a long process that I won't...
And a creative one.
And a creative one, yes. And really the nub of it was that we had four donors, the four siblings, who were not lineal descendants. And so we qualified with the IRS to become a public charity. And today we raise about $50 million from other sources other than the seven trusts that the family set up to benefit the organization. And just further, you ask what's the difference.
Yeah.
Private foundations accomplish their work by outsourcing, as I mentioned. Public charities accomplish their work by doing it themselves. So that's probably part of the reason that since I've been here, the organization grew from five staff to over 1,000 today, because mm-hmm. we need a lot of hands on deck to accomplish the work.
Yeah. And with that, I guess, comes accountability, because you're just not handing out grants. You're actually holding yourself responsible for getting things done.
Well, that's well put. There is no it, but for them, I would have been successful. It's but for us, we would have been successful.
Mm-hmm. And just to underscore that point, you have a donor relations department. I don't think a lot of people think of Pugh in a donor relations department. I believe your first donor was Jerry Lenfist.
He was, and sadly, we lost him very recently.
Mm-hmm.
And Jerry and Marguerite provided the very first gift to the Pugh Trust when we became a public charity. And that's yielded, hopefully, they would agree, a wonderful benefit for the oceans, and they supported our work in the boreal mm-hmm. forest, too. Today, we have donors that range in size from, you know, a couple of dollars to many millions of dollars, and they are individuals or private foundations or other entities.
Well, as I mentioned, the breadth and scope of what you do is truly breathtaking. Briefly, if you can, just give us the areas in which you operate.
Well, it is interesting. Our donors were both issue agnostic and geographically agnostic. By that, they didn't try to predict the world 70 years later. So we will work on almost any topic, any place, as long as facts and data are clear. We believe that we can make a unique contribution, that the issue is somewhat orphaned, because if many other organizations are working on it, they have really bright people and resources. I'm not sure we add too much to that. And we basically say that we won't enter a new topic or issue unless we feel that we have a 60-40 chance of winning on behalf of the public.
Mm-hmm.
Because the opportunity cost is very high when we take on new lines of work. So it can range from antibiotic resistance to corrections reform to trying to set aside 1 billion acres in the boreal to a new generation of parks in the sea. And as you see, people say, what do all these have in common? They have in common that they meet our investment criteria.
Mm-hmm. And part of that is you also have an end game. This is not vague. You have a very clear vision of what you want to accomplish when you go into one of these areas.
We are very clear. It's very quantifiable, there should be no ambiguity as to whether we delivered. We don't always win.
Mm-hmm, right.
And if we did, we'd probably be setting the bar too low.
Good point.
But generally in 3 to 4 years, we should be able to measure some success, and we set a goal that in 10 years we will be close to or have achieved our goal.
How important is bipartisan support in terms of embracing one of these issues and getting something done?
Well, we won't take on any topic unless we have bipartisan support, first and foremost, because you can't win.
Mm-hmm.
And we need some champions on both sides of the aisle, whether that's in the State House or the U.S. Capitol or internationally. And one of the things I think we've done well is bringing disparate groups to the table. Take, for instance, our corrections reform. Some of our very earliest supporters in 07 were more conservative groups like Right on Crime. I remember Newt Gingrich was one of our very first advocates because they really believed that people could pay their debt to society but do it in a much more cost-efficient and effective way.
Mm-hmm. You were a skeptic at that at first, weren't you?
Oh, you've done your homework. I was. I resisted initially, and my colleagues
presented you with facts.
They presented me facts and data, and they said, this is an economic argument about getting a better return on taxpayer dollars.
Mm-hmm.
And they turned out to be exactly right.
And what has been achieved, let's say, in the last dozen years or so around corrections reform?
Well, incarceration rates in this country have gone down by 11%. And many, many billions of dollars have been saved and redeployed to helping communities across the country. One of our first states to sign on was Texas. And the story I love to tell, the governor of Louisiana ran on the platform that he did not want to any longer be the most incarcerating state in the nation. And he called us in, and by darn, that's exactly what he's done. He is no longer the state with the most incarcerated individuals.
Well, an environment is another major focus area for you. You do things around climate change and around land and wildlife. But let's talk a little bit about what you mentioned before, the oceans, because I think more and more people are becoming aware, maybe even for the first time, that we have got some problems with the ocean. What should we be worried about, and what kind of work are you doing there to protect and maintain and restore marine ecosystems?
Well, we've ignored our oceans, partly because we can't see beneath the surface.
You're so right.
And one of our very first efforts here was to create the first generation of parks in the sea, a simple concept. We have parks on land. Everyone understands that. But we said we need to create 15 very large parks in the sea by 2022, and we're well on our way to accomplishing that goal. And they are scattered all around the globe. And the reason for it is it protects the fisheries, and it also protects the ocean floor. So we need to be conscious of how we're treating not just the oceans, but what, more importantly, what lives in them, the ocean floor, as I mentioned, and the surface from plastics and other pollutants.
Yeah. Are we overfishing?
Oh, absolutely. Overfishing from krill, the tiniest and probably most important fish in the sea, to large pelagic fish like tuna and others. Every fish stock virtually is depleted, and some of them questionably won't recover.
You know, one of my favorite places to visit when I go to the internet is the Pew Research Center. And being a numbers guy, I just gravitate immediately to the fact tank. So let me ask you about facts. As Daniel Patrick Moynihan so famously said, we're all entitled to our own opinions, but not to our own facts. But that doesn't seem to be so much the case these days. People seem to be entitled to their own facts. They selectively choose the ones that support their position and then question the veracity of others that challenge their belief system. Facts are at the core of everything you do. What are your thoughts about this?
Well, I believe that core principle has never been more important than it is today.
Mm-hmm.
And that's partly reinforced by the number of people who come to the website, millions and millions, in search of facts and data. And our founder said in the 1940s, when asked what should be the principles followed by leaders, he said, tell the truth and trust the people. And that's exactly what we've been trying to do. And the Pew Research Center is providing facts, data, information, and it's there for people whether they need it to inform their personal decisions or professional decisions as leaders. And I can't think of any greater public service.
No, neither can I. Because, you know, my impression sometimes, Rebecca, is that people are less persuaded by facts today than they ever have been. I don't think I've ever sat down with somebody who doesn't think the way I do and present them with facts and say, hey, Denver, I never realized all that. I think I'm going to change my mind. It seems to be at a much deeper emotional level. I just would be curious as to what you think about that.
I think it's important to separate opinion and being willing or trying to make one's case from facts and data. And I use the example of climate change.
Okay.
Talking with someone who may not necessarily believe or trust the science or such. My response is, look, you don't think your house is going to burn down, but you buy insurance. So let's really not debate that issue, but let's talk about an insurance policy that we might want to take out just in case it turns out that the impacts of climate change are as bad or worse than we know. It's a way to reframe the discussion, to have people sort of willing to talk about it rather than say, I can't believe you don't believe my facts, or mm-hmm. I don't understand why you don't trust this data. Unfortunately, I think that is how conversations are often broached today.
Yeah. That's a very smart way to approach it, I must say. Pew has a special commitment to your hometown of Philadelphia. I mean, as far back as helping to launch the Fox Chase Cancer Center. And you've done so much in the last 20 years around the Independence Mall. Just fantastic. And you do so much more there as well. What are you doing in Philadelphia right now that has you particularly excited?
Well, it's our home, home of the donors. And we support the arts. We provide support to the most disadvantaged in our community. And then we like to respond to big ideas. Some of those big ideas aren't always popular when we first float them, like relocating the Barnes Foundation to the Benjamin Franklin Parkway. But that's turned out to be, I think, a huge success
in terms
of preserving the collection and making it accessible. Right now, we're engaged in building, if you will, a park over I-95 to connect the waterfront back to the city, something people have talked about for at least 60 years, and now it will happen with some smaller support from us and some real leadership from the William Penn Foundation.
Mm-hmm. You were labeled many, many moons ago by the National Journal, I believe, as raging moderates, simply led by facts and truth, and you continue to be that today. And that is a pretty high compliment, especially in these times that we just talked about. What advantages has this brought to Pew? What has it allowed you to do being viewed in this fashion?
Well, I do love that label. And I said once when it was given to us, if under my stewardship this organization can keep that, I can take a sigh and think it was a success. Because I really do believe that we've been able to accomplish so much more by not being seen as driven by partisanship or ideology. We're just the facts, ma'am and sir. And it has allowed us to have access on Capitol Hill on both sides of the aisle. It's allowed us to be invited in to state houses across the country. And even though people may not always agree with us, they are willing to listen in a way that I know would not be the case if they thought we were driven by our own, if you will, bias, our own ideology.
Mm-hmm. Make me think of Jack Webb, just the facts, ma'am.
There you go.
Dragnet. Well, let's talk a little bit about bipartisanship, because you know many people think that we have gridlock in this country and none of the people's business in Washington is being done. I think you might think differently about that. So tell us, what is being done that would be encouraging for people to know?
I think there are many issues where we can get bipartisan support. We often focus on what divides us rather than the bridges mm-hmm. that unite us. Just this week, we will have a vote on providing support for our national parks and their deferred maintenance, a huge need. It has strong bipartisan support. We've been able to get strong support for antibiotic resistance and putting more money into the development of new antibiotics, which is desperately needed. And I could go down the list. Mm-hmm. I think it is picking topics that don't have and haven't been captured by the left or the right. Once those topics are captured, it's almost impossible to build that bridge. So we don't elect to work on those.
Right. As you said, you go for orphans that are just becoming ripe.
That's
a great time to get in and a great place to get in. You have been deeply engaged and also a very astute observer of the nonprofit and philanthropic sector, well, for several decades now. Sure. What do you believe it's doing well, and what would you like to see it improve upon?
Well, you're kind. 35 years to be exact. I think it's just extraordinary to me the amount of wealth that is coming into this sector, and that is a wonderful thing. I don't think our founders could ever have imagined the size and scope of giving in America, and that philanthropy really is a quintessential American sort of value, not that others aren't charitable around the world. So that is all very good news. People are trying and experimenting with new ways of doing things. That's also a positive.
Mm-hmm.
I just hope they don't disregard or discard some of the old ways of doing things, because a blend in a portfolio of work would be my hope. And what do I mean by that? Direct charity to helping the poor and such still has a very important place in philanthropy today.
Right.
And we should value that and embrace it. as do very unique and innovative ideas that are being tried by, I think, of the Chan Zuckerberg Initiative and others. So I hope it's a big – I know it's a big tent. I just hope it makes room for all kinds of philanthropy going forward.
Yeah, it seems to me that your nonpartisanship is almost reflected in how centered you are in those kinds of responses. Because often what you hear is that, oh, we need metrics, we need outcomes and things of that nature. And there's a lot of humanity to what the work that we do as well. And as you say, we need to be somewhere in the middle, just not one or the other. But there is a tendency of pendulum swinging too far one way or the other.
Well, I have a fair number of new donors that are in search of guidance. And the first thing I tell them is, first of all, there is not one right way. And anyone that tells you there is, run fast to the door. And secondly, however you elect to carry out your philanthropy, make sure it gives you a huge dose of joy.
Mm.
Because if it's giving you joy, that can be the greatest reward.
Yeah, yeah. And you're an optimist, aren't you?
Completely.
Yeah.
I'm an optimist.
Where did you get that? Were you born that way?
I probably was. You know, growing up in a small town in the South and, you know, to very loving parents.
Mm-hmm.
I really believe that my fate was in my hands and a lot of luck and some hard work would hopefully push me along the way.
Mm-hmm. Let me close with this, Rebecca. When an organization has grown from those five people or so when you started to now over 1,000 employees, the importance of building that organization upon values cannot be overstated. And you inherited an extraordinary set of values from the founders and have been a faithful steward to them ever since. Speak to those values and what a leader must do to keep them alive, to animate them so as to guide the organization in all its work.
Absolutely. Everything you do, from the small tasks to how you talk to the staff, has to be informed and guided by those values. Every year, I get a performance review just like my staff, and the very first question the board asks me is, what are you doing each and every day to make sure that we adhere to our values? Because we can win at a lot of things. We can be admired by many, we hope. But if we don't protect our reputation and foster our values, this organization will have failed. It will have failed our founders, and it will have failed exactly what we agreed to do as stewards of the organization.
Mm-hmm. Well, as you've said, 70 years to build a reputation, but you can lose it in a day unless you're always faithful to those values.
Exactly right.
Mm-hmm. Well, Rebecca Rimel, the President and CEO of the Pew Charitable Trust, I want to thank you so much for being here this evening. Tell us about your website and some of the information visitors might find if they're so inclined to come visit.
Well, we hope they'll come and come often to pewtrust.org. Be sure to sign up for our podcast. They're wonderful. We have all kinds of guests, newsletters, and enjoy it. It's chock-a-block full of data and facts and stories, and you can go to the Pew Research Center from our site. It's one-stop shopping, so come often.
There you go. Some of the best information you'll find anywhere, and you're quite the saleswoman, I must say. Thanks, Rebecca. It was a real pleasure to have you on the show.
Thank you.
I'll be back with more of The Business of Giving right after this.
I just finished months of chemo, but I don't want to talk about months. I want to talk about years. Treatments have gotten better, so I'm hoping for good years ahead. That's thanks to research funded by the American Cancer Society, the same folks giving me free rides to treatments, insurance advice, and a place to stay during chemo. I need that stuff like you don't know. And now that you do, please give at cancer.org.
If you're interested in reading transcripts of guests' interviews from The Business of Giving, you can find them at denverfrederick.wordpress.com. And now back to the show on AM 970, The Answer.
If I were to describe my next guest, the words I would use would be curious, eclectic, collaborative, and mindful. Those are wonderful attributes to have when you're looking to identify some new ways to solve some very old social problems. He has been an executive with J.P. Morgan Chase, teaches at the Harvard Kennedy School, and has served, or is serving, as the chairman of more nonprofit boards than you can count. Places like the Quincy Jones Music Consortium, the Thomas Jefferson Foundation, and New Profit. He is Jeffrey Walker, who is all of the above and so much more. Good evening, Jeff, and welcome to The Business of Giving.
Hey, Denver. How are you?
Doing great. You know, when I look at your approach to problems, Jeff, whether they're of the business or the social variety, much of that has been informed by music, which I know you love. When and where did that love affair begin?
I can't go a week without listening to live music. And so that started when I was in seventh grade and walked into the band room, and the band director looked at me in tall braces. You're going to play the sousaphone. oh, okay, and the tuba. Okay. So I started playing. And you can't really solo too much as a tuba player, so you have to play with others. And so thinking about, you know, working with others to create a sound is kind of where I started, platform, and I built from there. Mm-hmm. And I played in every band, jazz band, wind ensemble, concert band, everything else. And so I took a love of music and working with others to create something beyond myself. And my dad worked at the Apollo program, on the Apollo program in the Moonshots. And so I was impressed that he was working on something that clearly he couldn't do by himself either. And so this feeling of collaborating, of playing together with others has stayed with me my whole life. I think it's actually the theme of my life, is building those ensembles.
Yeah, yeah. And what is it about those ensembles that you have found to be so instructive in the way you have solved problems in both your business and your social service career?
Well, to be a good jazz player, for example, you have to play well, so mm-hmm. good. That's yourself. And then you have to listen well because others are playing different sounds and you're riffing off of them. And that you have to then create this sound that you're both working on together so you'll have an impact on an audience. And that's how I think these ensembles of change that I'm involved in, many, many of them, try to do. You have to listen well. You have to build collaborative strategies and processes. You have to look at yourself and make yourself better. That's a self-inquiry process. Mm. And so thinking about, you know, the successful ensembles, they almost always talk about it as a religious event when it works well. Something spiritual just happened. How are we working that well together? Mm-hmm. It's like, feels great. You know, how do we do that? And I continually look for that feeling, trying to unite people together to have that exciting, you know, opportunity to make the world a better place, but do it together.
Yeah. What's the feeling you get when you listen to live music? Because as you say, you try to do it every week, and I know you often try to do it at least twice a week if you can swing
it. Well, that'd be nice. Depends on the city I'm in, actually. So it's in a group of other people listening, mm-hmm. and they're reacting. And so the people on stage are having to get feedback from the audience and understand, this is working or not working, and here's the sound. So I still love recorded music, but that live feeling has another, you know, essence to it. You know, I'm a big meditator and with others in a crowd. And I think that the experience is different mm-hmm. Because you're getting that energy from others. And I hope someday to measure that what that energy really is. I believe it's there somehow. But I think the ensembles do that.
Yeah. Well, this ensemble concept may have been the springboard for a book you co-authored with Jennifer McCrae a number of years ago called The Generosity Network, and it's about changing the perspective of the world regarding working on the big causes of the day. How do you see that perspective changing?
Well, we're all learning how to do this better and better and understanding it's not one answer that's going to save the world. It's not one individual, or it's really going to be a more collaborative process. And so Generosity Network, and it's a course at Harvard now, actually going to guest teach in it this Monday. And it's all about lowering walls between donors and doers, people that are actually doing the work and people that are actually potentially funding it. And there's all sorts of other stakeholders involved in the process, but there's actually walls that are up because donors typically would say, well, you have to apply to me and have to apply for funding and I'll evaluate you. And then it creates fear. It creates fear from the donor side, thinking, am I making a good investment here, or they just want me for my money? And then from the doer side, you know, they're sitting there going, how do I get, you know, resources? And, you know, am I going to scare away this person? And so there's all these fears.
Yeah.
And so if you can address the fear part and lower the wall and start saying, what do you want? What are you passionate about? How can I help you? And so I'm not going to be treated just like a checkbook. I'm going to be treated like a partner who's going to help solve a problem that we're all going to work on together, and we each bring different resources to the table. And that's what the Generosity Network's about. It's ways to build those connections, to understand it's not about, the person raising money in a nonprofit, the development person, that's their job. And if I'm on the board or if I'm another officer, and I don't have to worry about it because I'm not a development officer, well, that's just not right.
Yeah.
You know, it's a partnership. And it's a relationship. And I don't even call them development officers anymore. These are major relationship people. Mm-hmm. People are kind of like helping us connect to others in a deep way.
Yeah. And it also fosters, I think, the way we have it now, a lot of dishonesty. I've worked with many nonprofit organizations. You're never going to tell a donor about the risk that their investment might fail. And you're probably going to be inclined to kind of fudge the overhead a little bit to keep it lower. So that whole sense of just a really open, honest dialogue is completely lost.
Lose the sell. You know, it's not about selling. You know, it's about collaborating.
Mm-hmm. Well, speaking about collaborating, what about philanthropists collaborating together? You know, we tend to work in silos quite a lot. I mean, it's my money, it's my idea, and it's my way. Are there some tools and techniques to try to bring philanthropists together around a common cause with a measurable impact?
Yeah, I love that. Measurable impact. You know, what are we going to have done, but do it in a collaborative way? We've developed a lot of different things. You know, we have things called Jeffersonian dinners where you're sitting there going, why don't we get people together around a table, have a whole table conversation, and actually share knowledge with each other, develop and lower walls, you know, between them, saying, hey, we can potentially solve things together. And, you know, I'm getting something out of this. I'm actually enjoying this conversation. I'm actually enjoying this dinner, you know. I'll come back. Let me do that again.
And as you say, it's one conversation at a table. It's not
just one.
Seven conversations among 14 people.
I cannot do, you know, 1,000-person dinners where everybody's talking to each other next to them about their dog. You know, actually having a conversation with intelligent people is my joy. And so that's what we have to do. So there's all sorts of different ways to start bringing people together, particularly donors, so that they see there's advantage. Mm-hmm. And it's actually more fun. So that, you know, I would get together with some of my friends and say, I really want to have an impact, for example, on early childhood. If that's what your joy is too, I'll hook you up. And music or whatever it might be. And so let's bring these people together. And isn't that the role of an ensemble player? Isn't that the role of an orchestrator to help unite people around these common causes? And when you do that, the energy goes up, the joy goes up, the resources start rising again. And so we're starting to see that not just in small donors, but very large donors. Very large foundations start to understand that partnerships are probably really critical for our long-term success. And they're re-looking at it in this, what we're calling system change models.
Mm-hmm.
You know, how do you look at these larger system questions and how do you join together with other influencers to affect the change you want to see?
Yeah. And it also requires a little bit of a redefinition of what success is, because we have a very classical way of my organization and how much have I done. But really, it's now got to be more around the issue than really around the organization.
Problem focused.
Well, let's give us an example here, starting with malaria, because I think that's an absolutely great one. And your role there was vice chairman of the United Nations Secretary General Envoy's Office for Health, Finance and Malaria. How did you look at tackling that huge challenge?
I got involved in the process, but when I was retiring out of J.P. Morgan, a guy named Ray Chambers connected me up. And Ray is one of my life gurus, kind of like understands how to go after.
He's quite the guy.
Certain of the problems in the world. And you find those, right? You try to be them, but also find them. So Ray said, come on board, work with me, something called Millennium Promise first. And then Ray moved over to malaria after he saw some kids dying in Malawi at feeding stations, and I happened to be with him. So he said, let's get together and let's figure this out. So Ray did an amazing job setting up things like Malaria No More and others, and we were helpful in the process. But I actually said, you know, malaria is a great example of system change, and I've written about it, I've analyzed it, and it was one of the early ones that we started looking at, saying, how did all these individual and organizations come together and have a common goal of lowering malaria, deaths from malaria, down to near zero? How did that happen? And did it work? Well, we set a goal of 10 years, used the Millennium Development Goals as that common measure that we could go after, and we didn't quite accomplish it in the 10 years, but it went from around 1 million to deaths per year down to below 200,000 a year.
Right.
So 1 million people a year's lives have been saved.
Pretty good.
And it's not because of one person. You know, it was because there's an orchestration, there's a collaboration. People have been working on malaria for hundreds of years, but in particular, a lot of money over 20 or 30 years. But somehow this shifted the conversation. It made it so the USAID and, you know, the World Bank and Partners in Health with Paul Farmer and Harvard and all these different stakeholders came together, the President's Malaria Initiative, to have a common cause. And how do we measure that? And so we said, well, how are we going to measure it so everybody knows if we're going closer or not? Oh, we've got to get bed nets. You know, these are the things we use to stop the mosquitoes from coming in and insecticide impregnated. How we work with Sumitomo. How do we get production going? It became all the questions that we as old, raise an old private equity guy, and so am I. And so we look at kind of going, what levers can we pull? Oh, we need financing for the bed nets. How do we go with the goal? Oh, well, we need more production. Let's think about that one. So instead of just taking, you know, a siloed global health approach, let's start opening it up to lots of other different stakeholders who can contribute.
Mm-hmm.
And let's also make sure that we're working with the governments so that it's sustainable. So it's not us, the outside world, coming in, you know, helping, you know, these poor people. It's actually working in partnership with individuals, philanthropists, faith-based leaders, and others, like in Nigeria, which we did, to affect the change.
How do you get something like that started? What was the moment? I mean, was it Ray? I mean, what was the moment that you were able to bring that force to bear on this problem?
There was the moment of, let's do this,
and that was
in Malawi, saying, oh, we have to figure out how to do this. And then the process of, let's start pulling some people together to talk about what do we do.
Mm-hmm.
We didn't know it was going to be BedNet, you know, and we didn't exactly know all the people we were going to bring to the table.
I got you. So you didn't have the answers, but you had the questions.
That is the biggest advantage I know in life, to not have answers, is actually to understand what the questions can be and should be, right? And so that's the fun part, is asking people these questions about, what do we do now? What do you think? Hmm. You know, and how does this come together? And let's have some Jefferson dinners. Let's have some convenings, you know, and talk about this. We actually did one the White House helped with, and then Gates helped with. And that's almost too easy to say because it's hard to do. But you can do this in a micro way too, by the way. You know, local community, et cetera, bringing people together to say, what do we think we ought to do? How do we join together to kind of figure that one out? But also leveraging your network. I think that's the joy, honestly, of being as old as I am and thinking, I actually lived a decent life, I think. But I have a lot of people I know, and I can use my networks. And you know, my network's getting better and better because I'm not here to sell anything.
Mm-hmm.
I'm here to find some other people to work on these really interesting issues and complex puzzles so we have fun playing together.
Yeah.
And it does. I do this all the time, and it's so fun to do that and find other people to get energetically interested as well.
It sounds like also that a little bit of humility goes a long way. So when you start out these things with that sense of humbleness, it's amazing the things that you can do. Let's return to your love of music. It only stands to reason that you love to be able to bring music and make it available to kids all across the country. Now, that is a very big goal. What do you do to start that?
So we started this conversation with Jennifer McCrae and a guy named Quincy Jones. And Quincy's well-known record producer. I'm not sure young kids these days remember Quincy, but he is. And he's Q, and he's such a great guy. So we kind of sat there on his foundation, and he was going to give some money to an orphanage in Cambodia. And we said, great, that's awesome. And let's do some more things. And we said, Q, what about music, you know? Shouldn't you do something in the music world? And kind of what do you really moves you? And we start talking about kids and the kids that don't have it, particularly the kids in the inner city, that the schools have been closing down music programs left and right.
First thing to go.
And there's some things around like VH1, and there's nonprofits. There's a great one, Little Kids Rock by David Wish Runs, and there's Mr. Holland's Opus and a bunch of others. Well, it said, do we just back them? And you're kind of going, that's not what we did in malaria. What if we did something similar here in the music space? So over time, we brought Berklee College of Music together. We brought the teacher unions together. We brought people in each of the cities together. And there's 70 nonprofits, and we bring them into the room, and we got the Grammys to say, we're willing to be that incubator, that orchestrator, because we don't have all the answers, but we care about music, and we have a lot of artists that care about music with the Recording Academy. And so let's work on this together. And so rather than focusing just on an NGO to work with, we started saying, let's focus on cities. And so we picked Philadelphia and Nashville, for example, to say, do we share common goals? That the problem is we want kids to have more exposure to music. I grew up with music, and I think it transformed my life.
Yeah.
It teaches leadership, and it teaches scores go up. There's lots of evidence of what happens. So let's make sure that all kids K through 6 have music. They're taking some music program in school. In school, not after school. And then let's make sure kids 7 through 12 have culturally relevant music. Now, that was the whole, you know, we had days of discussions and negotiations. Because
I can hear the debates.
I'm not here to say, you know, Long wants to teach classical music. Awesome. But it doesn't fit every city. You know, and Little Kids Rock wants to teach modern rock. Awesome. But it doesn't fit every city.
Mm-hmm.
So how do we say we're going to empower instead the head of the music programs in each of the cities to figure out what's culturally relevant so we motivate the kids.
Mm-hmm.
And we motivate the parents, too. When the parents get around this, the energy goes up. The kids show up at school more often. And so that's what we did. And so we have some common goals by city. We're helping them raise resources. We're helping them network. We're helping artists now start taking ownership of the cities themselves and saying this is important to them, bring social media strategies around this one. So we have all these different NGOs. We've got lots of different academic institutions that prove the results, as well as provide teaching talent and, mm-hmm. and some other things. And so it's really fun. And now we're finding more and more people who are joining with us in the Grammys Music Education Coalition we set up and co-founded and say, join with us to do this. It's a blast. And so people are kind of going, oh, okay, that sounds fun to me. Mm-hmm. And we are having a blast.
Yeah, well, that's absolutely fabulous, Jeff. And I do love your concept that you bring to these things of the toolbox, of making these tools available and then letting those local people decide what they want and how they want to use it. Because once you try to foist it upon them, it's never going to work. And because how would you know? You know? And they own it a little bit more. Well, let's continue along that same line. And, you know, there's been tremendous positive change that has occurred as a result of the efforts of social entrepreneurs. I mean, they have really achieved some remarkable results. But if we're going to dramatically increase the level of that change, it's going to take something called systems entrepreneurs. And I know you co-authored a piece about that in the Harvard Business Review a while back. What is a systems entrepreneur?
Systems entrepreneur is an orchestrator. It is someone who can have that managed ego to say, I have questions, but I don't have the answers, but I'll help pull together those that might have some answers
mm-hmm.
or might have some approaches. And so there might be several different innovations, several different social entrepreneurs and enterprises that we can unite for a common goal. We might need to figure out that there's some communication awareness strategies. We've got to make people aware of these solutions. You know, if nobody knows about them, what's the point?
Yeah.
You know? Maybe we ought to work with somebody in the system itself, in the school system. You know, who's in the school system that can be our partner so that they'll take responsibility when we bring these innovations in to embed it. So when we stop, when we as philanthropists stop, it stays. And that sustainability is a big issue. And so the system entrepreneurs share data, share best practices, and most of them, this is Ray and our team, you know, around malaria, they're small teams.
Mm-hmm.
And they leverage opportunities to say, what if we as philanthropists fund not just social entrepreneurs? Social entrepreneurs are really important, and most of them are key innovators. But how do we fund this other group that helps unify it around this common problem and has a set of tools
mm-hmm.
that they can use to unify people? One is, what's the common problem? Well, in music, we figured out it was lack of K-6, 7
mm-hmm.
classes. Let's measure that. So it drives you to the measurement when you identify what the problem is. And then number two is, there's some things called system mapping. A consulting firm called FSG helped create it along with Bridgeband and others. So let's map who cares about the problem. If you map who cares about the problem, you may have partners.
Yeah, who are the influencers?
Influencers, partners, opportunities, mm-hmm. levers, whoever that. But so don't then drive to the problem. Drive to the answer until you have identified the problem and those who care about it. And then you can say, now let's figure out what to do about it together. And that's what a system entrepreneur does, is start to introduce a number of these tools to figure out this larger systematic change. And systematic change can be large things like the Freedom Fund does, focusing on slavery, the 42 million people in the world that are enslaved, mm-hmm. or the N Fund focuses on neglected diseases, and mm-hmm. 5 neglected diseases get them down to 0. But the people that are running those, Nick Rono for the Freedom Fund and Ellen Agler as the N Fund, they're the system entrepreneurs. They're the ones that are kind of saying, you know, join with me, donors,
mm-hmm.
that will be more effective together. And I'm not here to sell you that I have the answer, but I know together we'll actually have a better answer.
Bring it together, yeah. And they really understand and appreciate the full context of the problem. And
try to.
But I mean, they understand that the solution is going to have to take into account
that full
context.
But they're a note of action that others are drawn to then, saying, well, they've done more work on this than others, so let's join with them. You know, New Profit, that's what we're doing, is creating a lot of these system entrepreneurs and incubating them, saying, how do you partner, like we've been doing for 20 years, with social entrepreneurs? And in fact, a lot of social entrepreneurs now are becoming system entrepreneurs.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Wendy Kopp is now that for Teach for All.
Mm-hmm.
When she started Teach for America, I call her a classic social entrepreneur. But she's evolved, saying, I want to look at this larger system. You know, that's what Gerald Achaving is doing in Europe. He's looking at this larger system of employment and skill-based employment strategies. So I think it's natural, not just for social entrepreneurs, by the way, but others to roll into this orchestration strategy.
Very interesting. Let me ask you two more things about philanthropy before we move on. And one of them is a relationship between the CEO and the board chair. And there's probably no more important relationship in a nonprofit organization. And it's so good to talk to you. I get to speak to a lot of CEOs, but not so many board chairs. So to be able to hear from your perspective will really be interesting. What are the elements of a healthy and a robust relationship, as well as the warning signs that the organization is about to suffer because that relationship is beginning to break down?
I totally agree that this critical relationship, because some people just talk about how the board versus the CEO, but actually the chair is so critical to making sure the board communicates well with the CEO, actually has a healthy culture and atmosphere when you're actually having board meetings so that they're constructive, they're generative, right? Creating interesting thoughts and ideas and openings of networks. So when I arrive to a board meeting as a board chair and I'm working with a CEO, if I don't have people come out of the board meeting going, that was interesting, I really learned something. And if they didn't say also that, you know, I think I contributed something, I actually think what I said might have been helpful, then that's a great board meeting. Mm-hmm. If they think it was just a bunch of PowerPoints, you know, and somebody presented to them, or, well, gee, that was the only time we ever heard, you know, once a quarter we get together for a board, that is terrible.
Yeah, I've been in a lot of those.
They're like, oh, my God. So the best and healthier relationships, in my mind, are constant contact with the CEO. So Vanessa Kirsch at New Profit, who's the CEO there, and I talk every Friday morning for an hour and a half. Mm. And we just talk. What's going on? What's important? What can I help with? What other board members can be helpful? Can I call them and kind of bring them in? Gee, you have a donor there issue? Let's figure out how to get that donor interested in what we're doing, right? Or you have a management issue, right? Well, whatever it is. So you become, hopefully, a partner in the process. And then you model that because you model that with others in the organization.
Yeah.
And other board members model that too. And so each board member contributes something differently. And your job as board chair is to figure out how to match them. And it's that ensemble creation. It's that, you know, you play really well that instrument, you know? So I got to hook you up with somebody that really needs that, right? As opposed to we're just kind of a mass of people who are there to control you. And that's it's a terrible strategy. And so the board chair is that conduit, is that connector.
Mm-hmm. Let me ask you about donors. You know, some organizations don't really have a lot of hands-on volunteer opportunities for donors, yet some of those donors are yearning for a personal connection with that organization. And you've spoken about this concept of avatars. Sounds interesting. What is it?
I believe in life that if I can find people who I wish I was but I don't have time to be, which I call an avatar, then I'll support them. And so if I can have as many avatars in the world that I just love and that are really pieces of me in different forms, then why wouldn't I just support them?
It's a lovely concept.
With all knowledge, network, contacts, I don't care. Of course, they're me in a different shape and form. You know, awesome. So that's the deal, you know, is finding people like that. And so it gives me energy when I find people like that. You know, many of them are younger, you know, so maybe helping them, you know, get in there. Or somebody are passionate. And I have, you know, it's my old venture life. I do too many things. But figuring out those that I can work through and leverage. It's my old CEOs of companies. Now these are not just social entrepreneurs, but these are system entrepreneurs. Mm-hmm. These are others that are passionate. How do I engage them and help them succeed? And that does take many in the philanthropy world, I think, need more of this, some self-inquiry saying, you know, am I doing this well? Am I actually, do I have a managed ego? Do I try to pull my ego more out of it than I can? It's impossible to take it all, but, and then work on the bigger issue.
Mm-hmm.
And have some sympathetic joy. So sympathetic joy is defined as happy that others are happy and joyful and not jealous. And that's something I and hopefully many of us continue to work on sure that I'm not, oh, I wish I had that.
Yeah.
Oh, he has a great car. I wish I had that car. No, I'm just happy he has a car.
Yeah.
You know? And so how are we doing that in life?
Mm-hmm.
And getting people to help do that as well.
Well, one way to help do that is through mindfulness. And you, Jeff, were one of the earliest proponents, certainly in the business world, of mindfulness and meditation. What got you started down that road?
Yeah, the contemplative world is important to me, and it gives me that center. I started meditating in 1973 at the University of Virginia in the middle of a field. And I now am the outside chair of the Contemplative Science Center, where it studies meditation, and we're building a building right on that spot.
Wow.
Which is very strange.
Yeah, really.
Very strange when they told me that. I had no input into it at all.
Yeah. Well, they probably didn't know where you were laying on the field.
So. Well, that's, you know, when I'm a first year in college, yeah, who knows where we are. But that connection between self, spirit, and others, and understanding that we can meditate and modify our brains, or modifying our brain cells. And so understanding that working together to create people who have lower anxiety, lower depression, and these are all the things that I've been helping support over the years in research around that show that if you do have a long-term practice, your mind changes. You become, I think, a better person. You are able to focus better. You are able to be more collaborative. You're able to work in teams better. You're compassionate. I can show you, and there's lots of science now. We actually have science going through the FDA near approval for ADHD, for mindfulness. Instead of taking drugs, isn't this better? And so we're using these tools to bring it to kids in schools. We're bringing in kids in higher ed and, and early ed and using it in healthcare.
Yeah.
And so we help set up companies to do this and fund those as well. So it's been a center part of my life. In the practice of that, I go on retreat twice a year. I find many others who, you know, the CEO of Aetna is my sangha, my work group, you know, that kind of holds us all accountable because it's kind of hard to do by yourself. So if you kind of like, hey, how's your meditation going? You know, well, or how's your yoga? I mean, this is not selling one thing. It's really a whole set of practices that help us reform our mind and body to be a little more useful in the world.
Yeah, and it's interesting you said about the fact that you don't do this by yourself, because I think many people envision meditation as being a solitary activity. And I guess there are opportunities and there are benefits in doing this in a communal way, correct?
Totally. It's different. I mean, it's okay to go by yourself. Absolutely. You should do that. But it's a different experience, as live music is a different experience than recorded music. When I'm practicing with others, when I'm meditating with others, and then I'm having discussions with them afterwards, you know, as to how'd that go? What do you think? Oh, God, I was thinking a lot. You know, oh, okay. Well, that's okay. Yeah, you know, have a think about that. Gee, there's a different kind of meditation you can do. There's a loving kindness meditation. Oh, what is that? You know, how does that work? So with others, you get better. And with others, there's an energy feeling of just like jazz guys talk about, you know, something spiritual that's going on. I think that's true in the meditation space as well.
Let me ask you about mindfulness as it relates to an organization, particularly a nonprofit. You know, I think all of them are striving to become more relevant and become a magnet for talent. What can leaders do to create a culture of mindfulness?
It's a great question. And the business school started down this path before anybody else. So it's interesting that business can lead that. At Harvard, they call it authentic leadership. At Stanford, they call it touchy-feely. You know, Deepak Chopra teaches a course at Northwestern Business School. You're sitting there going, wow. And now it's being infused throughout business. I taught meditation at J.P. Morgan. And
at a time. That was a while ago,
20 years ago, and we had mindful leadership as well. And so it's not just about the problems, but it's also about the opportunity to improve yourself, to make yourself more effective. And Bill George, who writes about authentic leadership and does some great teaching, Scott Krenz, one of my partners, they teach at a place called 1440 Multiversity out in California that's a new retreat center about leadership and bring companies in and country managers in. And what they're finding is that people are working better in teams when they have these skills. They actually are lower incidences of anxiety and better higher end performance levels. There's all sorts of other aspects of the change, behavioral health issues. So now Cigna is adopting those programs with a company called Happify that's embedding it. We had another one we invested in called Headspace and Insight Timer and a bunch of others. So we have an investment group called Bridge Builders, which has seven of us now who have joy in investing in this space. We don't have to. We can do other things. But we actually love with each other. And there's a guy named Charlie Hartwell who's our collaborative glue that kind of holds us together, right? You always need something like that, right? And we love to get in retreats together, but then you find a deal going, this Insight Timer thing, wow, there's 4 million people that have signed up and there's 1 million users and they have 2,000 teachers and maybe we can bring these ideas out to the world. And there's other business strategies too. And then we can in healthcare start improving health by investing in companies that can bring these tools and techniques to medical students, to the understanding that we can bring these tools through academic research to make people's lives having lower suffering. And that's in my life, if I can lower suffering in the world, enhance joy, I'm done.
Yeah, that's.
And if I could do it through ensembles with others, I'm so done.
Yeah. Very nicely and very simple. That's what you want to do. Not a lot of complexity to that, but boy, profound. And you touched on a moment ago higher education.
Yep.
And boy, the pressures of grades, alcohol, and addiction, and sexual violence, and really just trying to fit in and be popular. Lots going on at that age. But you believe that these mindfulness tools can be very valuable, and you're doing something about it. What is it?
So at the University of Virginia, at Contemplative Science Center, we've teamed up with the University of Wisconsin, Richie Davidson there, and Penn State, Mark Greenberg and team, to create a course called Flourishing. And it's a first-year course. Mm-hmm. Get 3 credits. And it's a flipped classroom, so you read everything ahead of time, and then you actually just get and talk and work with each other in classroom. And they're talking about these issues because our student health services, I'm on the board of the University of Virginia, for example, and I was on the board of Berklee College of Music. There is more stress than when I was in college. It was still stress, okay, yes. But now somehow with technology, with sexual pressures, with drinking and everything else, so student health services are at their wit's end. And so waiting until somebody's depressed and suicidal to show up in the student health is not the answer.
Right.
It's giving them the tools to be able to address these problems themselves or with others in their dorms, for example. And so what this course does is giving those set of tools. And by the way, it's not just mindfulness. It's whatever works for you.
Mm-hmm.
It's a set of tools, as you say before. It might be yoga. It might be Qigong. It might be just talking.
We're all different.
It might be hanging out, you know. It might be kind of opening up to others and knowing, just knowing that there's resources around and teaching teachers that as well. So the course is done great, and now we're talking to a number of other universities about using similar models for that flourishing style.
Yeah, fantastic. And even better than getting those tools to young people in college is to getting them to them earlier.
Yeah.
And at that University of Virginia Contemplative Science Center, you are looking at the younger students, and the proving ground for you is the 28th largest school district in the country, which is Louisville, Kentucky. Tell us about the Compassionate Schools Project.
Yeah, this is one that's been going for almost 5 years now. And we've teamed up with the local community foundations and the Brown family and a bunch of others to bring 25,000 kids, K through 5, kindergarten through 5th grade, the tools of mindfulness, yoga, social-emotional learning, and health. And, wow, if we could give tools like that to the kids at their early age so that we're not trying to fix things when they're 18 or 21, then we're going to have a better world. And so we've been doing this, and the results are through the roof. And 25,000 is not a small test.
No.
But it actually is a research project. And there'll be really great papers coming out of it. But the results are impacting Louisville. And it's been happening over the last couple of years, and they're embedding this program into their school system, which is the goal of a philanthropist, is to help support some of that. And if you can actually tie research into it to prove that the kids are in school more often, that the kids are performing better grade-wise, that they have the ability to not get into fights as much and some other things, which is all true, then isn't that a good thing? And so then we use those as models. And so what happens is this is a system change strategy at the city level, right? Mm-hmm. You're doing it in partnership with the mayor. The mayor is amazing. The superintendent, the schools, and figuring with them how to embed it, as opposed to saying, I have a nonprofit, and these are all good ones to innovate, but I have a nonprofit that is going to come give you this research.
Yeah, right.
And you have to do the following to allow me to bring it to your school system.
Yes.
It's just not a partnership mode.
No.
And that was really good. We developed those ideas. But I think we're all in this world now of starting to bring together lots of these different tools and being collaborative and working with the people who's going to be affected. And that's in proximity. And that's as close to the problem as we can get. You know, involving those people at that bottom part of the system, and then being this collaborative glue, be this top around model that helps them get access to those tools to affect the change they want to see.
Well said. Well, let me close with this, Jeff. And maybe how you do what you do is unique to you, but there may be some advice there for others. I think the conventional wisdom in philanthropy is to, if you really want to make a difference, you need to focus your efforts on one or two things, maybe three. You've made a real difference, but it's been a lot more than one or two or three things. I mean, malaria, the Berklee School for Music, Harvard, the Contemplative Science Center we talked about, New Profit, Just Capital, Millennial Promise, the Lincoln Center, Film Society.
Lots of things.
And so on. And that doesn't even include your business and your investments. Is there a secret to be able to juggle so many things and continue to bring vital and valuable contribution to each?
Having joy while you do it. And so if I'm not having a good time by the relationships that I have or the collaborations I'm working on, I move on. Also dropping things. You know, when they're interesting in the early stages. I like the early stage idea. We're figuring stuff out. And once it becomes more mature, then I'll move on.
Mm-hmm.
I like to advise more than I like to be on a real board. I go on real boards.
Yes, you do.
But I'd rather work with a CEO or work with a great innovator or an orchestrator to accomplish the change we want to see and use my network to do that. And the network's a big effect. And so being able to introduce people to others, saying, I'm not going to do it for you, but I can hook you up with somebody that can. Or to unify and leverage off of other people so I can affect the change I want to see together is really important. So avatar effect, you know, understanding this ensemble effect, to my mind, makes my life, you know, more manageable enough that I can be involved in a lot of cool stuff.
Well, manageable enough that we were lucky enough to have you come here this evening. Well, Jeffrey Walker, the systems entrepreneur, if I may describe you as such, thanks so much for being here this evening. If people want to learn more about all that we talked about or your approach to the things we discuss, where can they go for additional information?
Well, you can go on Google and just call up Jeffrey Walker and look up some of my articles. And Bridge Builders is another one. And that's if you want to know about our investments in the contemplative space, you can look up Bridge Builders and see some of the investments that we have. Look up Contemplative Science Center at the University of Virginia and then go to New Profit. We're writing a lot of articles about system change as we speak, a lot of system entrepreneurs and social entrepreneurs, and that newprofit.org.
Mm-hmm. And Bridge Builders is bbcollaborative.com, and it's a great gateway for people who are interested in meditation. Thanks, Jeff. It was great to have you on the program.
Great, Denver.
And that is this week's show. Thanks for listening. Have a great week, and do return next Sunday evening for The Business of Giving.
The preceding program is paid for by the friends and partners of The Business of Giving.
3-star general Michael J. Flynn, head of the Pentagon Intelligence Agency, knew all the government's dirty secrets.
He was one of the most respected generals in the military.
Flynn knew what the intel world had been up to. He understood its funding.
He ordered the first audit of the use of contractors. This set off alarm bells.
The explosive new documentary, Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost, and covers the facts behind this scandal.
Flynn told the truth. He was the most dangerous person for Donald Trump to hire.
I find out the worst enemy that I'm going to face in my life is right here in America. They took my assessment and they wanted me to change it. And I was like, I'm not changing it.
They had to get rid of Flynn.
With in-depth interviews, archival footage, and never-before-seen personal records of the man behind the headlines.
I just felt like I was drowning.
Flynn, Deliver the Truth, Whatever the Cost. Available now. Watch it today. Go to SalemNow.com. SalemNow.com.